You're listening to a Wheeler Centre podcast.
Being a victim is not a very empowering position. You're stuck in victimhood. And so I thought, what if my characters actually did have a say? That's why it's a reimagining. It's not a historical novel. It's a reimagining.
Welcome back to the Wheeler Centre podcast. In this episode, hear from host Tony Birch in conversation with visionary playwright and author Jane Harrison. Harrison discusses the work of reimagining the past in her first novel for adult readers, The Visitors, a radical retelling of the events of the 26th of January 1788 from a First Nations perspective.
My name's Tony Birch and it's a real pleasure for me because I know Jane very well. I know Jane's work and have had the real privilege of working with Jane Harrison before, so it's my great fortune to be here tonight. Before we go any further, obviously it's important that we acknowledge where we are tonight. Tonight we're speaking to you on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country, Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Greater Kulin Nation, and we want to pay due respect to all members of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung community, certainly to elders within that community, past and present. We want to extend that respect to all First Nations people who may be here this evening, but we also want to extend that to everyone who's here tonight. We welcome you, we welcome your communities, and we welcome your respect for elders in your own community. So Jane Harrison is a descendant from the Murawari people. Her first play, Stolen, which many people know so well, toured internationally and was a co-winner of the 2012 Raka Kate Chalice Award. That's for the University of Melbourne, bestowed by the late Bernard Smith. Rainbow's End, another production of Jane's, won the 2012 Drovers Award for the best touring production. And both Stolen and Rainbow's End have been featured on secondary school curricula. Jane's most recent play, The Visitors, premiered at the Sydney Festival in 2020. And will be published as a novel in 2022. Her novel, Becoming Kiralee Lewis, won the 2014 Black and White Prize and was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Awards and the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards. And Jane is the Artistic Director of Black and White First Nations Literary Festival, which will be in March next year, and believes that stories have the power to reframe our national identity. So with all that, we can get into a conversation. I suppose one of the first things to ask you, Jane, is that this is such a multidimensional story. I was reading a really praiseworthy review of the play this year in Sydney by the review by Larissa Berendt. So just if you could give people, an understanding of its life, so that we know that it's been a play, it's a novel, it's part of an opera production. I'd really love to hear, as a writer also, where the concept first came from and how did you develop that concept into this multi-genre storytelling that we have today?
Sure, there's a few questions in there, but I'll give it a go. So really I started writing the play version back in 2011, I was writer in residence out at Monash University, and I had 6 weeks to put down the first draft, which I did. And the inspiration at that time, I'd had the idea for quite a few years sitting in the back of my brain fermenting, and some of the kind of things that came together around that idea were the Northern Territory intervention, which we've all forgotten about now, but was quite a horrendous, had a damaging impact on Aboriginal communities. And I recall a friend of mine saying, Aboriginal man saying, now when I walk down the street, people will think I'm a pedophile because I'm Aboriginal. And I was absolutely devastated for him on his behalf because you might remember that signs were going up in communities all around Australia, remote communities saying, no pornography, no alcohol, no this, no that. And I thought, really, those signs could go up in any community.
Outside Parliament House.
Yeah, absolutely. Canberra, yes. Mm. Hotbed of pornography. and yet Aboriginal communities were targeted, and I just thought that was problematising Aboriginal people. And I thought, in particular, men. I thought men suffered really terribly through that intervention. And so I wanted to write, I consider myself to be a feminist writer, but I decided I wanted to write something about Aboriginal men, and sought permission too from my community to do that as a woman writing about men's stories. But I thought it was really important. And what happened around that time too, I saw the play 12 Angry Men, and I thought, that's such a good plot.
That was going to be one of my questions.
That's such a good plot.
Yeah.
And I consider myself to be quite good at character, but maybe not so great at plot. So I thought, I will borrow that. I will permanently borrow it, which I did. And then, of course, the idea of writing something about the First Fleet, the arrival, January 26, 1788, I thought that hadn't been written from the First Nations perspective. And I thought that's a gap in our history. We've heard stories like Kate Grenville's stories, Secret River, etc., about white histories that contain reference to Aboriginal people, but we haven't had the Aboriginal perspective on some of those stories. So I thought, I'm going to try that.
And was your first impulse that this will be a staged...
It was. So that's where I normally write. That's what I write to for the theatre. That's been my background. I have written a YA novel as well, and I think I've always wanted to write fiction, but I was more known as a playwright, and so I thought I'll write it as a play. At that time, no one was interested in a play about men. I think it was because it was about men.
Unless it was 12 Angry Men.
Unless it was 12 Angry Men.
Yeah.
So it stagnated. It had lots of workshops. It had workshops at Melbourne Theatre Company, and they shortlisted it 2 years in a row. And in the end, they said to me, we don't think it will sell 13,000 seats. So they chose not to do it. So I kind of despaired because I thought the idea was great. And so I thought, well, I'll write the novel and I'll have more of a chance of getting it published as a novel than I will getting the stage play on. So I wrote 5,000 words, sent it off to an agent. She sent it out to pitch, and I got a contract to write that novel.
So that interests me. I mean, there are many things that interest me there. I want to go back to craft because I'm interested in something that I don't want to call it adaptation, so I want to get some sense from you of what you would think of it as. So you have this... Well, when I'm saying from the perspective of not being able to sell 13,500 seats, that it's failed on from their perspective, I'm talking about. But it's interesting that you then get the contract to write the novel, but of course you do get this staged in 2020. So at some stage while you're writing the novel, what happens for someone to back the
sure.
stage play?
So Mogulin Theatre Company had workshopped the play back in 2013 as part of the Yellowmundi Festival, and they really liked the play, and one of their artistic team was looking for a project to do as part of Sydney Festival because they had a relationship with Sydney Festival. Wesley Enoch was there,
yeah.
That they would do a play every year. Mogulin would do a play, and so Lisa Marie Siren had directed a play for them, and Frederick Copperweight, the director, wanted a vehicle, so he really liked the visitors, and so he did it as part of the Sydney Festival 2020, and it was a sold-out season. But then COVID happened, so of course.
So was that 2020 staging was the first big public staging?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
So you're writing the novel at the same time, aren't you?
I started writing the novel after production, so I had that production.
Okay. So one of the things that I'm interested in here is that so you've done a script for stage at that point, and then you decide to write the novel. For someone who I don't write script, and any attempt I've made has been a miserable failure, so going back the other way, When you're traditionally a scriptwriter, but I know that you have a strong interest in writing prose fiction, how did you see that challenge? Because I imagine it's not simply, I'll just adapt this script page by page to a prose style. Did you simply have to put that aside, or did you follow the script closely? Because there's so much in the novel that clearly it can't be part of a script.
Absolutely. And so that was the challenge for me, to write things like, in a play you don't write descriptions at all, you know. Directors
as
hate.
I found that.
You don't write stage directions.
Yeah.
Directors hate them with a passion. So there's no sense of those, things like the inner world of the characters.
Yes.
You can't do that in a stage production. It's got to be just dialogue driven, and so it was a case of me turning 15,000 words in play script into 65,000 words. And so to do that, I really had to go and do a lot more research, and that's what I did. I read all the accounts of the First Fleet, and in particular any contact they had with Aboriginal people, and also about the natural world. I really wanted to create a sense of the natural environment in Sydney, in that area. And so I thought also I'll go a little bit back in time. The play starts when they're meeting on the shores of Sydney Cove with the meeting about to happen. Mm-hmm. While for the book, I thought I'll take them back to their communities and show them journeying to the meeting space. And that allowed me to show their communities, how their communities operated, the journey, the natural environment. And then, of course, I just... had to go much deeper into researching it, including all the plant life, the medicinal plants in the book. I researched those. I found out things that there are cassowaries in Sydney. I didn't know that.
Another question that I want to open up into our characters. One of the things that if I'm doing research for a book, for a novel, I then start to worry that the research will overtake the story and it becomes a sort of a history.
Yes.
Or that, I mean, some versions of historical fiction suffer from what I call product placement.
Yes.
People are so determined to work out how you made a loaf of bread in 1850.
Yes. Exposition.
Yeah. So, exactly. So one of the real qualities of this work, there's a great sense of authenticity and plausibility in the historical fiction, but it does read as quite naturalistic. So were you able... What's your approach? So you're doing all that research, around country, around ecology, which is obvious in the book, but you seem to be able to knit it or weave it into the story where it isn't either predominant or it isn't sort of just there for window dressing. Mm. So how did you feel about knitting research into a narrative so it appears seamless?
Yeah. I don't know. I really don't know how I managed to do that, but I'm glad I did. Yeah. So thank you. I think it's just really that it's very character-driven, and I think because I had such a strong sense of those characters and their backstories, their lives as community people, I sort of wove... The exposition bits, the history bits, the ecology, those kind of things in with their personalities and their characters. And so, I framed it around those, because it's quite unusual to have a book with seven protagonists.
Yeah. I want to talk about the protagonist now. And just before I do, my other bit of housekeeping is that when we get to about... 8:15, we're going to open the floor up for questions. So please think about any discussion you want to have with Jane so that we can hand the discussion over to you at about 15 minutes' time. So I want to talk about the protagonist. Now, I know that, again, looking at the staging of the play that Wesley Enoch did this year, with the seven protagonists, the seven Aboriginal men, even though it's set at that moment of the First Fleet arriving, they're wearing contemporary dress in the play. Now, the names of the seven characters, and I did try and test Jane before. I don't want all of them, but I know that one of them is Gary.
Yes, Gary.
Gary's one of my favourite. Nathaniel is another one. So the first thing that could or might puzzle a reader is that you have these seven Aboriginal men who are yet to have ever had contact with a European, but one of them, his name's Gary.
Yes.
And they all have European names.
They do,
so
yes.
I love that as a device because just for me, thinking about that and reflecting on Larissa Berendt's review of the play this year by that Wesley Stage, or is still on?
It's still on,
yeah,
yes.
Is that it gives it a real, there's a real question that this is a contemporary issue, this is the now. But I'm interested in getting you to think about that. I mean, I don't want to sound too glowing of you, but it seems really brave for you to do that. I don't reckon I'd have the guts to do that because I probably doubt that I could make it work.
Right.
You make it work so effectively. So why?
Thank you.
Why is one of our lawmen called Gary?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I looked at the plot of 12 Angry Men, they were called Juror 1, 2, 3, mm-hmm. etc. And that did my head in because I'm not good with numbers. So what I did was I cast it with actual actors that I knew. So Uncle Joseph is actually based on Uncle Jack Charles,
yeah.
The beautiful late Uncle yeah. Jack Charles. And so I then coded the names. I wanted them to have a slightly old-fashioned sense because it was 1788, but I didn't want them to be the noble savage. Mm-hmm. So that's why I dressed them in contemporary clothes
yeah.
and gave them those names because I wanted it to be actually a contemporary novel mm-hmm. and not a historical novel. And also I think when I started writing it, perhaps Indigenous language use wasn't as prevalent as it is now. There's been a lot of it. Writers who've paved the way, Anita Heiss and
yeah.
Tara June Winch
yeah.
and others have paved the way for more inclusion of Aboriginal languages. But in 2011, when I was starting, I probably didn't have the confidence to give them traditional Aboriginal names.
Yeah, it's interesting though because I love both the work that Tara and Anita, they're both doing remarkable work. But I actually think there's something really powerful in what you did. I mean, because it makes you think about these are men and what they have to say is essentially relevant to today.
Absolutely.
And there's no essentializing or romanticizing of their characters because of... I mean, I wouldn't be game to call any character Gary. So I think I always try and think of really exotic names, and So now I just want to because I had written a note in the discussions we've had before, and certainly not in any of the reviews that I'd read. I hadn't been aware of 12 Angry Men as an influence, but it is obvious when you read the novel. I loved 12 Angry Men. I've only seen the film version, by the way, which is brilliant. Mm. But one of the things that I love about that film, and I want to talk about this, how it impacted your work, and then I want to bring it into a contemporary discussion, is that the power of rhetoric or the power of debate is such in that play is that people's ability to persuade can be based on bullying. It can be based on the loudest voice. It can be based on domination. Or it can be based on reason, ethics.
Mm.
So what was it in the play, other than just think, okay, I can use these men? Was there something essential quality in that play around that idea of how we debate, how we argue that influenced you?
Yes, that's a really interesting question, and I probably hadn't even considered that myself in adapting that plot line to this play. But I think people have said that the book's very much like a land council meeting with all these characters sitting around it. And in the play version, just to make things confusing, is that there's females actors cast in it, and the opera also has women singers, as you heard. So it's not
necessarily men in those two productions. But in the book, I went back to my original impetus, which was to write about the men. And I wanted them to be reasonable people. I wanted them to have knowledge and order. I mean, that's what I despaired at with the Northern Territory intervention, was that problematising of Aboriginal men. And the Aboriginal men that I knew are family men. They're knowledgeable, they're knowledge holders, they've got sense of humour, they're, caring, they're, you know, good partners. And I didn't see that represented in the media at that time, that particular time.
So there's something, again, not as an aside, when when we listen to the voices tonight, I think it's interesting that it's certainly not confusing to have women play those roles. Again, it adds to the complexity. Yeah, you start to ask questions about men's knowledge, women's knowledge, women's secret business. So it raises really important questions, and it's provocative, I think, in the really productive and energetic sense. Just though, on that notion of how men are represented, the other thing, I really think this is unique to this book, so that if we're to look at what we might call the sort of history of narrative and storytelling around first contacts, I won't make a comment on, say, Secret River, but the fact is that Secret River is told from a European perspective. We have the Aboriginal characters are always on the margins of the text, and Kate Grenville has given a reason why she did that. Mm-hmm. And then when Andrew Bovell did the stage version, we had a woman narrator in the play to shift that. But most, when then we get work from Aboriginal writers and creators, from an Aboriginal perspective, it is, and again, it's often in a very, what we might call, pre-contact traditional sense or in a traditional manner. I don't know of anything like this where you are telling the story from an Aboriginal perspective, but you're not trying to dress it up as some pre-contact narrative. I think that's astounding. Now, I want to bring it into, because you get a sense of it being contemporary, how far or you want to take this or discuss this is up to you, because you may not want to discuss this at all. I don't want to go into a discussion about the voice as such. You know, it's doing our heads in, and I was talking to Barry Judd at university today, and so many Aboriginal people are just really suffering at the moment. But what I thought when thinking about the book and what you've achieved is that we have these seven men, and what they're doing is they're having a vital discussion which is going to profoundly impact on their nation, on their communities. And they do it in a manner which is so reflective, so thoughtful, and ultimately so culturally vital, that it made me think about there's something in the words, exchanges of these men, it's the very thing that we're lacking. So just to keep it in the historical perspective at the moment, but I'm interested in that, in the sense of you've produced something where you show not only, all right, Aboriginal men are not monsters, they're, you know, profoundly important lawmakers and knowledge holders, is that if there was there something in the book generally where you were actually, I want to convey to my readers, Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal readers, about possibility or about another way of thinking about country?
Yes, I think what I was aiming for is agency. Mm-hmm. I wanted those Aboriginal characters to have agency, because colonisation happened to us and we didn't have a say in it. And, you know,
we were just victims of it, in a sense. But being a victim is not a very empowering position. You're stuck in victimhood. And so I thought, what if my characters actually did have a say? That's why it's a reimagining. It's not a historical novel. It's a reimagining. Is because I wanted them to have agency. What if they had a choice in this matter? And would they choose out of their sense of not fear or suspicion or distrust or even the stories that they'd heard of Cook's Desert 18 mm-hmm. years before, which, you know, profoundly shocked them, the way they were treated in that those encounters.
Mm-hmm.
But what if they could choose? What would they do? And would they choose to act within their own sense of protocol, which is to welcome people to country?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it gives them grace. And I, yeah, that's what I wanted.
That's a beautiful word to describe it. What for people who haven't read the book yet, what are some of the choices, or what are the potential outcomes or decisions that they have to grapple with?
Yes, they need to come to a unanimous decision about whether to welcome them to country or shoo them away. And in the beginning, they're all pretty much aligned to the fact that they're going to send them on their way. They remember the stories of 18 years before, and an Aboriginal man was shot in the leg and bled profusely, mm-hmm. and things were stolen, trees were cut down, all sorts of horrid things happened in that encounter. And so they don't really want them on their country again. They've seen boats coming and going. They're familiar with the sense of people visiting for a short period of time and then leaving. And so they, when the philosopher, Walter, begins to kind of question their belief system and unpack it a little, they have to go back to their own sense of what they believe. So, for example, Nathaniel believes that the pull of your own country is so important that why would these people be so far away from mm-hmm. their own homes? Of course they'll have to go back to their own homes, because you need to look after country. Why? How could you not? And so, you know, it's kind of poignant and a little bit heartbreaking, really, that you know, that they rely on their own experiences to make this decision ultimately.
Which, I mean, again, that word you use, grace, is important here, because one of the ways you could think about that is that these men are naive to the danger that's going to visit them. But I think that would be disrespectful. I think grace is a much more important word. You talk about Walter as the philosopher. So when we have this ensemble cast or characters, how did you... Because one of the things, again, with 12 Angry Men, if anyone's seen the film, Lee J. Cobb, isn't it, who plays this really angry man, like really angry, and he attacks the Henry Fonda character for his sort of philosophical view of the world. So it's the bully that initially holds sway.
Yes.
So how did you think about, I suppose, the different intellectual and cultural characteristics of these men and how they would balance off each other, or how they would persuade?
Yes. So it was tricky to get each of them to change their minds to allow for ultimately them to fulfil a welcome to country at the end of the... Spoiler alert for those who haven't read the book. Sorry about that. I have to make sure that each of them has sufficient... They can justify their position. So in the book, Gordon is the one who's the warrior, mm-hmm. and he's the one who's most adamant. It's his country that they're on, and so he's got the most to lose, and he is adamant that these people are not to be trusted and that they're barbarians. And we actually see some evidence for that mm-hmm. on the boats, which is not historically accurate. The hanging that they observe actually happened on shore 3 weeks later after colonisation.
Yeah.
It didn't happen on the boats. But the other...
thing that they observed, which was the black man on the boats, on the First Fleet, travelling between boats along the rope, hand over hand, and the other sailors shaking that rope until he falls into the water and drowns.
Yeah.
Actually did happen. It's historically accurate.
If so I could...
I've probably gone off the question.
No, you haven't gone off at all. I mean, it's interesting to think about it, those observations. So one of the books that... another novel that I thought about when I was reading your book was Kim Scott's That Dead Man Dance. So in Kim's novel, there is I suppose the ultimate despair in the novel is this great potential for cohabitation that evaporates through violence. So that there are the potential of interaction, which happens to some extent. There's the potential of accommodation. And there is a sense also amongst some of the Aboriginal people in that are wanting to welcome. But the interesting thing that you said about the whole notion that people would go back, why wouldn't they want to go back and care for their country, is then the Aboriginal characters, or a couple in particular, staggered when they realise that the Europeans are not going anywhere, they're staying, and they want to take over country because they can't conceive that you would simply take over someone else's country. But one of the things with Kim's work is that I know that one of the reasons he wrote that book was to say, okay, here was the potential of something that could have been different, a different society, and part of his motivation is for contemporary readers to consider that as a contemporary discussion to go forward. So thinking about the play and, of course, the opera and the book, you've talked about, you know, to give dignity and agency to Aboriginal men. I suppose, you know, your work, like my work, is in numbers, is read by more non-Aboriginal people, and your plays are seen by more non-Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal students. So producing this work, is there a... What would you want non-Aboriginal readers and viewers of the play to learn from the work that could be, again, part of a discussion about where we're going rather than where we've been?
Yes, that's a good point. I mean, I do... My first audience is always Aboriginal people, to kind of use my skills to put their stories on the page or on the stage or the screen. But of course, you're right, it's most of the audience is non-Aboriginal. And again, I think I want a non-Aboriginal audience and readership to, you know, it's a cliche to use the word journey, but to go on to a meander on this path with these characters and to observe them and to see things just from that First Nations perspective, how that, you know, people have said to me that after reading it, they'd always heard that Aboriginal people have a connection with the earth, but they hadn't really understood it until they read this book, which was astounding to me, because it's such a common trope for us, that, you know, the connection to country, and again that sense of grace and possibility, as you said, it's about. Again, I didn't time it to coincide with the referendum at all, but I think it's addressing some of those concerns of having a voice, having agency, having dignity, and you know what we want from. I'm pro-voice, you might might have gathered that.
Yeah. It's okay.
that referendum is an opportunity for us to have that seat at the table, which is what my men are doing, having a seat at the table, having a discussion, reflecting, putting their points of view forward, and really considering this decision, really.
I mean, that's amazing that you can't not think of these men and not consider what a voice might be. It has become so pertinent. Mm. You use the word dignity, and I suppose this is another question, or it's not. I don't know if it's a question, but I would have to say that when I was contacted this morning to step up
very early this morning,
step up early on my way to work, and didn't hesitate, and started to think about our discussion, and remembering back to when I read the manuscript and thinking again about what's happening in this week or what's been happening for some time now. I think the other, well, to me, something that's vital in the book is that we're going to have a referendum on Saturday, and I think largely we're going to make a decision based on very shallow debate, a lot of misinformation, clearly a lot of racism. And I was thinking of Warren Mundine's slogan, "If you don't know, vote no," which a lot of people would have heard. There's nothing worse that I could think of than to say to someone, if you don't know something, in other words,
if you're ignorant,
that's in your court. Yeah, that's the best.
This is an invitation. The book's an invitation.
Yeah, so what I thought was, Jane, was that the book highlights the potential of genuine cultural discussions and debate. There's a vigorous debate amongst these men. So it's probably worth saying here, it's not to suggest that the referendum or the voice discussion shouldn't be debated and debated vigorously, but debated with dignity, debated with relevant information rather than misinformation. And I think, yeah, there'll be more than two, but two centres of despair, I suspect, after Saturday. I'm not confident that this will succeed, but there will be one, just that, the hurt that a lot of Aboriginal people will feel who have invested in the voice of Parliament. But the decision has been made based on anything but a dignified, inclusive discussion. Now, I want to ask you a final question based on this, and then please, after I've asked this last question, we're going to turn it over to you. An American philosopher who I follow, I've read a lot of work, Elizabeth Minich, she has a book on thinking. And one of the things that she would argue, and she's argued this particularly in relationship to climate denialism, and she said the people whose main argument is denial, what they're doing is encouraging us not to think. Yeah, don't think about the climate crisis because it'll do your head in. So, yeah, don't think about it, it'll go away, which it won't. Or don't think about the possibility of having a voice to Parliament because it's complicated and you mightn't get your head around it, so just don't think about it. So, if you don't think, vote no. And what she argues very strongly is that we should encourage thinking. We should encourage thinking at a very early age. So one of her big ideas is ethics and philosophy being taught in primary school. Encouraging young people that vigorous debate and discussion is healthy, not unhealthy.
Absolutely.
It's not something to be frightened of. And I think what denialists do is they create a scare campaign where we're scared, we fear discussion. So what I would ask as my final question is that one of the things I think is evident in your book is what you're, I think, sharing with us is that Aboriginal knowledge holders in Aboriginal life, and in this case of these men, it's about having really informed but vigorous discussions, which the outcome of which is to enrich ourselves. Where do you think we're at with that possibility, or are we nowhere near that?
Wow. What is the state of the nation? I think
that'll take you half an hour.
I think you're absolutely right in your assessment that there's been a lot of misinformation and denial and fear-mongering amongst people. You know, as happened with the same-sex plebiscite and, you know, earlier land rights and other times in our history where we've tried to make decisions to better make society more equal place. And I do despair. I'm not all that confident on the outcome of the referendum. And I also don't want, you know, with this book and with the play and the opera, I'm not telling people what to think. I'm inviting you to sort of reflect and to think deeply about these things. Because I think that's, you know, Aboriginal culture is such a place of enrichment. And for anyone that ventures into that space, they can't help but be enriched by it. And so I just think it's, again, with the voice, I think why would you say no to something where it's really people having a conversation and talking about their lived experience in order to improve society? And we failed so far in terms of especially our remote and remote communities. I think we failed them. You know, we're a rich country and yet people are living in dire circumstances without services. Incarceration rates are horrendous for Aboriginal people. Children are still being removed from families. We need to do something differently. We need to do that, and it starts with the conversation.
Thank you. Okay, so it's over to you, good people. So you get a prize for first question.
Oh, great. What is it?
I'll tell you after. A date with me.
Thanks.
That's a good prize.
Jane, and as someone who I did see your first reading way back at MTC, I think it was, and I picked up the 12 Angry Men kind of similarities back then, and that plot is all based on coming to a unanimous decision. So, you took that plot, but are you aware that that is an Aboriginal way of solving a problem too? Does that have sort of cultural...
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you sit down until you all agree is the way it would have been in traditional communities, which can take days or maybe even longer than days. That's my understanding. Would you...
No, I was just trying to think of arguments I've tried to solve at home. I agree straight away. Yeah.
I think the unanimous decision is taken from my experience of Aboriginal ways of consensus.
Someone else? There's just there.
Hi, Jane. It's Emily here. Really fascinated in the way you've been working on the three forms all at once. You've talked a little bit more about the novel and the play. So I'd love you to talk a little bit about the process of how the opera came into being and also how that has been different in terms of almost like the density of working with the language change, because the play is one thing, then a novel clearly you had to put more in, as you said, and I wonder or suspect with opera there might be a little less because the music comes in, just to talk about how that and the pleasure or the challenges of working across those three different forms, what's that done to your sense of writing and language with the piece?
Yes. Well, my writing background was as an advertising copywriter, so I'm kind of used to writing to a brief, and so I don't feel like I'm precious in the writing I do. I feel like I adapt the writing for the audience, and so I had a masterclass with Richard Mills from Victorian Opera. He said, this is an aria, this is recitative, this is slash this, slash that, and get it down to 15 pages. Well, I thought, I can do that. I can distill it. And that's what I really did. I distilled the play version down to something much slimmer. And the music, of course, does the heavy lifting in the opera. and allowing for that space. But I saw a run the other day, and even though, you know, I think, oh, it's missing that funny line, or that line always gets a laugh in the play. The book is funny too, by the way. We didn't mention that.
But sorry.
The play is quite funny. Although one reviewer said that he didn't like my jokes. The puns, that was just one review. So the opera's obviously a much finer kind of version of that, but I felt like the other advice I got writing the opera was to keep it big, keep the stories really big. So I've got those big turning points in the play version that I've kept in the opera. And I hope that answers your question.
What's the excitement, though, like when you see something like the opera for the first time? I mean, there must be a... Is there a nervousness or just a pleasure? I mean, that I find
yeah,
that...
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what you're getting. Like, last Thursday was the first time I heard the whole thing in its entirety, and someone else has created that. So the score is about that thick, and he's worked for, you know, 18 months on that score, and it's really quite beautiful. He was told to write tunes, good tunes, and I found myself singing them over the weekend, not as well as Shante.
It's an incredible act of generosity for someone to spend that much time on your work, isn't it? There's something quite beautiful about
that. Yeah, and that's what I love about theatre. Is its collaborative nature.
Mm-hmm.
As a playwright, you write, your play script is a blueprint, and the architects and the builders are the cast and the director, and they inhabit that world that they've created for the period of the production. And they bring all their skills and knowledges into it as well. And so, you know, it's a better product than those words on the page.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to ask you another question and then we'll close. But we said at the outset that you're the director of the Black and Bright Festival, and it'll be on next March.
Yes.
What can people look forward to next year?
Well, the opening night is so exciting. A well-known writer called Tony Birch will be...
See, I haven't been told any of this.
I asked
you. And when I asked Jane at the back, she just said, "You said you'll be free on these days, so that just means I do what I'm told." So, yeah. Sorry.
Your contract will be in the mail.
Keep talking me up.
So Black and Bright is a four-day celebration of First Nations writing. Most of the program is free and accessible to all. We welcome you. We do everything from fiction to memoir to a book club to an event with elders. We have a young tent embassy which has young activists. We do, what else do we do? We do the Bogong, which is spoken word piece. We have our big poetry slam. And we always commission a performance for opening night. It's quite different from
That's
other
me.
literary festivals, and you're part of that performance.
No, I'm not.
So put on your dancing
Shante
shoes.
Shante will do that.
No, we've got.
Yeah, I'll get Shante to step in and do Phil Collins for me. But anyway, that's my go-to at karaoke, by the way.
So 14th to 17th of March.
Okay, so it'll be something to look forward to. So, just to close, I'll just get a final thought, because we have talked about. I think there's a lot of anxiety about the referendum and I think a lot of despair potentially. We were talking about this to a group of undergrads at Melbourne Uni today, but one of the things that I said that I've actually found to be a real positive is that one of the things we've been exposed to in the last few months is much more publicly a new generation of young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people speaking up in public, taking a leadership role. I've done a couple of things for trade unions just to give them information, and always done that with younger mob, and their vitality, their knowledge has been profound. So for me, my thought is that, yeah, there's a lot to be disappointed about, But I actually feel really, I do feel really optimistic that there's a young generation of people we need to allow to move forward and, you know, take leadership roles. So I suppose, Irene, your role of just observing that, but particularly as directing a festival like Black and Bright, I would imagine that, you know, and I know, like me, you're pessimistic about what might happen on the weekend, but would you share that optimism about what young mob are doing?
Absolutely. I have said something negative about my generation before, and that the world might be a better place when we've moved on.
Well, just out to pasture, if that's okay.
Or just put out to pasture, yeah. Because I think our generation is holding these young people back.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, I've got a lot of optimism about the future, but the future is now. The future is now. We need to make these decisions now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Not in 30 years' time.
No, absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. So,
and we've got a lot of allies too. That's the other good thing to notice. You know, I was at the rally that was here a few weeks ago, and just to see the number of people who are allies.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot. I noticed from my two younger daughters, my two younger daughters in their 20s, a lot of their mates, white fellow mates, they're really passionate about these issues as well. In closing, to know again that you can purchase Jane's book and have a chat to her afterwards. So most importantly, please thank Jane Harrison.
And I'd like to thank you too, Tony. Thank you.
You've been listening to Tony Birch in conversation with Jane Harrison as part of the Melbourne City Read series. It was recorded on the 9th of October 2023 at the Wheeler Centre for Spring Fling. Spring Fling was proudly supported by the Victorian Government through Creative Victoria and the Melbourne City Revitalisation Fund. Special thanks to official bookseller Readings and accommodation partner the Sofitel.
The Wheeler Centre podcast is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. You can listen to more podcasts or explore videos, news and our full calendar of events at wheelercentre.com.